We're celebrating lots of things at Holden this week, including Hearing Impaired Week. One of the things that having our sisters and brothers from the hearing impaired community among us this week raises for all of us are the ways in which all of us in our daily lives, without even thinking about it, have all kinds of barriers that separate us from people who are different than we are. This is not a new question for any of us in the room as individuals. It's not a new question for any of us as people of God. And it's not a new question for Holden Village or for our various churches. But it is such a complicated question, and it is, to my mind, such an urgent question. And it's brought sort of to the fore of our thinking again as we're with the hearing impaired this week, and as we look forward here at Holden Village to a multicultural emphasis and Rainbow on the Mountaintop beginning next week. The way in which we include is a constant question before us, and one that we all need to work on. My name is Jody Kretzman, and most of the time I teach in Chicago and do some research and writing and organizing there, and try to work in my daily life through a set of neighborhoods and relationships and struggles that constantly expand me and remind me about how, in fact, my own walls are thick and high. Ingrid and I live in a neighborhood where our local high school has 72 foreign languages spoken, and so that the sort of challenge that it means to us to be sort of open to a variety of ways of viewing the world and a variety of ways of other people's experiencing us is fairly constant in our lives. We spent a lot of time, too, thinking about the church, particularly the ELCA, in the last few years, and the question of inclusiveness. Let me just make a comment and share a quick chart at the beginning here as one way that I have found at least helpful for me to begin thinking about all of the complications in this question of inclusivity. And then we're going to be hearing from three different points of view from the point of view of somebody who is from the hearing impaired community, who's experiencing both what it is to be locked out and to raise questions about being included, from somebody who, from the point of view of a feminist, feels that kind of wall in the church more than occasionally, and from the point of view of the gay community, who feels those walls up there fairly high at times. In working particularly with people of color on this question of inclusivity in the last couple of years, Dr. Pete Perro, who's at the Lutheran School of Theology, has been to Holden a number of times, has joined with some of us in leading us into thinking about this question of inclusiveness and what we mean by it. Two simple, quick images to open the question, at least in one particular way. There are lots of other ways to go at this. Sometimes those of us who are in mainstream institutions, or put another way, those of us who are in power in mainstream institutions, or put another way, those of us who are straight white males in mainstream institutions, think about inclusiveness as sort of opening the doors for people who are not like me to come in and be like me. Right? So you sort of get a circle here with a whole set of assumptions, right? A whole set of norms, a way of behaving, a set of standards. And then you get a whole lot of weird groups out here on the edge. And the trick is, if you really want to be inclusive, you want to open this up, what you do is you open doors. You open spaces so that these people can come in. Now, what they're doing when they're coming in is they're getting all the right degrees, they're passing all the right courses, they're saying their stuff about God in all the right ways, they're being more orthodox than I could ever be. And so they are included. But what we get when we include people in that way is pretty much a set of mirror images of what we started with, except people sort of look a little bit different. Pete Perro and others are working on a different model and saying, what would it be like if rather than this stuff, if we just thought about a series of circles that each retain their autonomy, where, for instance, people from a variety of multicultural backgrounds, from African-American backgrounds and Asian, Native American, various Hispanic backgrounds, and people with hearing impaired, people with from the gay and lesbian communities, can retain their gifts, can retain and magnify the gifts that that God has given them, and that somehow we work together in some dialogue to create a new definition of inclusiveness that in fact embraces everybody in their particularity. Is that possible to do? Is it possible to have a set of definitions that doesn't radiate from the center out, right? Is it possible to have a set of definitions that really do radiate in conversation among folks with their own autonomous and powerful statement of who they are? That's a different kind of challenge, and in my view, there isn't probably a church in the United States that's close to doing that at this point. But it's an interesting sort of, for me, it's an interesting sort of pull. It's an interesting sort of way to think about being in the 21st century when it seems to me if the globe doesn't begin to look like this, we'll probably have trouble getting into the 22nd century. That's two different ways of thinking about inclusiveness. I want to just take a few minutes now to have the three panelists share a little bit about the way they come at these questions. And we'll start with the complex set of negotiations that we have going on here. Beth has already communicated with us this evening and will continue to now.
Oh, I didn't know I was supposed to start.
Oh dear.
I'll give you a little bit of my background, maybe. I have a master's degree in deaf education, and I spent 5 years as a parish worker in a deaf Lutheran church in Philadelphia. I taught school for a few years before I had my baby. So I have worked in churches, also in the secular community. A big barrier always is communication for me, for hearing impaired people, because obviously we can't hear what people are saying. My church is unique in that it has a deaf church, but it's really a joint church with a hearing congregation. So it's two Lutheran churches that have united and have fellowshiped together. We share the same building. We share the same social events. We share meetings. Our biggest need is having an interpreter, of course. You know, as you can see tonight with the two interpreters here, my husband's interpreting for me now. Another barrier also is that hearing people normally, and I don't blame them, but it's normal, they want to take charge. They want to take care of hearing impaired people and guide them through everything. And hearing impaired people are like you. We come from all kinds of backgrounds, all different kinds of families, all different kinds of educational levels, all different kinds of skills and languages. Most of us do not have a strong command of English. I do, because I was not born deaf. I became deaf when I was 6 and a half. But most deaf people, English is really a second language. You know, so in church, our liturgy really needs to be translated into American Sign Language. And when we worship, you know, with our hearing congregation, we have an interpreter, but we also have a deaf lay reader. You know, deaf people will get up and read the lessons. That's very important for deaf to feel a part of the church. Not always to be looked at and not being able to be participants. We have deaf ushers, you know, and they're hearing us. Deaf people help on the altar. At the altar. At the altar guild. Yes. They help set up the altar for communion. We do have a deaf Lutheran pastor in our country, yes, we have some. But our church doesn't have any right now. And so we have a hearing pastor that signs. When we have worship with hearing people, it's very nice to remember the speed of two different languages, that they're not the same. The hearing people can run through the Lord's Prayer, just spit it right out. But deaf people are signing it. Slower, because they're putting it into a visual picture. So there are some ways to think about, you know, just to begin with.
Thank you. That's really helpful. We'll have, I think, a good part of the time together to interact. But the question of power has already been brought up. We are reminded as hearing people that we like to take charge. And taking charge is not always the best way to facilitate some real inclusivity. I suppose that those of us of the male persuasion are also sometimes reminded that we are likely to take charge. And that that reminder is equally well taken. Ingrid, do you want to remind us of that?
Well, I guess that's the point, isn't it? I mean, I've sat in this room and talked about this issue for 15 years, and it hasn't changed. And I always sort of feel like I'm whining now, because it's not new. And most of the women I know, and lots of the men that I know, share those feelings, but I'm not a theologian and I can't discuss that competently, but I've been taught at Holden mostly, and in other places too, by many people who are real knowledgeable about theology, about the Bible. I've been taught that it doesn't have to be so male-laden as it is, that the language original works and translations are layered over with societal stuff, the translations, so that they've become progressively more male through the centuries, so that it isn't just my little personal bad feeling about it, I think it's a little broader than that, that the images for God don't all have to be male, for example. There are lots of images for God in the Bible that are female, or that are neither male nor female. And I like having a God that's bigger than that. So then when Sunday after Sunday I sit in the pew and sing, through him, with him, in him, in the unity of the Holy Spirit, all honor and glory is yours, Almighty Father, now and forever, amen. And I say the creed, in which I even have to call the Holy Spirit male. You know? Really, in the creed, the Holy Spirit is male. We believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeds from the Father and the Son, with the Father and Son. He is worshipped and glorified. It feels petty to bring all this up again and again, but I have to say that it's real painful. That unless I do tricks on myself Sunday morning in church and fool myself and try to divert my attention, I get upset and I want to cry. It hurts so much. So I wish we'd change. It seems so simple. We teach Sunday school classes on it in my church, and the men and the women in the Sunday school class say, oh, it's no big deal. It doesn't matter. So since it doesn't matter, let's just go on the way we are. And I say, well, if it doesn't matter, then let's try, say, 50 years of just using all female language for God. And then we'll sort of balance it out and see how we like it. You know, then we'll make a more rational decision because we will have had some experience on both sides. And I don't want that, really, personally, of course, myself. That isn't what we're saying. I mean, I think we're saying broader images for God. We're talking about loosening up the language so that it isn't also male-laden. In the LBW, practically every hymn refers to God as He. A lot of it refers to people as He. My daughter sort of looks at me and says, what is all this He stuff? Or she used to. She's used to it now, but it just doesn't make it. It's just not all right to have to worship in male language Sunday after Sunday. And, you know, it's not new. This is not news to you. But I'm telling you that it is still very painful for a lot of people. The other thing is that I'm on a national church board, and so I see a lot of what goes on at the ELCA. And it's all real male-laden. The heads of all the departments are men, except for the department about women. The powerful people are all men. I went to the installation of all the bishops, and I sat there and wept. You know, the whole thing, the installation, it was in Chicago, had lots of women up there, and they were all in bathing suits and with scarves dancing. It was so inappropriate, I couldn't believe it. And then there were lots and lots of men processing and processing and processing, all with layers and layers and layers of heavy black clothes on. So there were all these men in black clothes, they were all white men, processing forever. And then these few women in bathing suits with scarves dancing during liturgical dance. It was absurd. I mean, and so I thought, well, all right, I quit. I give up. This church is not my church. I can't deal with it any longer. This is it. And then, as you may know, Chrissy Grum is our vice president. And she came in the end of the procession after 50 or 75 or however many male bishops there are, came in all in their black robes. And they tried, I found out later from Chrissy, they tried to make her wear a black robe too, and she refused and wore a purple dress with a red scarf. And she had her blonde hair piled high on her head, and she sailed in there like a ship of steam. And so she was, I think, the third to the last person in the procession. And through my tears, I found myself laughing. And I decided, okay, I won't leave the church yet. But it is tiresome. I mean, it's, why? Why do we, I mean, we say we don't believe this stuff. We say we're beyond this. We say, oh, of course, women are included and it's fine and everything, but it's not fine. So I'm just reminding us that even though we've been saying these words for a long time, things have not changed very much.
Particularly appropriate, I think, just as we have the summer celebrated, the 20th anniversary of the ordination of women in the Lutheran Church, to be reminded again that that work is new work for Lutherans in the United States, and that from lots of people's points of view, there's lots to be done yet. Spence?
I'd like to talk just for a few minutes about the perspective of gay men and lesbians. I can't speak directly from the experience of lesbians. I can speak from the experience as a gay man, about having many friends who are lesbians talk about some of that. And I want to start by saying that I think there are many experiences in common by people who are excluded from that first circle that Jody sketched up there, the power circle. Many of us who don't fit into that circle have some things in common, but each one of us, each group of us, has something that's unique or particular about our experience, and I want to focus a little bit on what's particular about gay and lesbian experience, not to deny the commonalities we have with other people who are excluded. the question for me that was phrased as a forum title, who's included in inclusiveness, is not a rhetorical question, because for many of us, gay or lesbian, we don't even make it past that question. And I was reminded of this again this week when John Schramm and I did a session on the issue of power and authority in the church. And John did a historical overview of the way the church has confronted some of these other issues through time, such as the issue of race and the issue of civil rights, such as the issue of women and women's role in the church. Painful, painful struggles for the church at different times, but basically the church has come out with some degree of consensus that yes, we need to be inclusive on the issue of race, and yes, we need to be inclusive on the issue of women. And as Ingrid has pointed out, we may have made that, we've come to that agreement, we just haven't put it into our practice very well, or we're still divided about how far to do that and how far to take it. It's much different on the issue of gay and lesbian people. The church is very divided whether or not we should even be included in the inclusiveness. And that, again, is a difficult one for those of us who are gay or lesbian. I would say one of the biggest problems that gay and lesbian face that's different than most other groups is the problem of invisibility. We don't stand out because of our skin color. We don't stand out because of our gender. We don't stand out because of our age or our physical abilities, things that tend to make people visible as different to other people. Gay and lesbian people don't have that. And that's a mixed blessing. Sometimes we use that to our advantage in terms of basically shielding ourselves from the hostility of society, and we choose to remain closeted, to pretend to be heterosexual in order to not face the full brunt of society and the church's anger. But other times, it's terrible because it reinforces the self-hatred that we get from society's message about who we are. If I were just to use the example of Holden Village, social scientists and folks who study the issue of sexuality agree that roughly 10% of the population is gay or lesbian. So if we've got a village population of 400 people here this week, you can expect that roughly 40 of us are gay or lesbian. Well, here's one of them. Where are the other 39? The fact is they're here, we are here, but we're invisible. And that has something to do with about the way we do or don't feel included in the communities that we're in. The problem of invisibility dovetails nicely with the problem of silence on the issue. The longer we remain invisible, the more there usually is silence on the issue. Or if the issue is talked about at all, it's talked about as them, those homosexuals, those people. Because very few of us who are gay or lesbian risk the hostility of the church and society in order to speak for ourselves. I say the basic ground rule on this issue, and this is probably the case on other people who are excluded, but particularly for gay and lesbian people, if there's silence on the subject, the community is not being inclusive. And particularly if there's invisibility in the subject, if you don't have gay and lesbian people who are identified as gay or lesbian in your community, then you're definitely not being inclusive. The problem is because society is so thoroughly homophobic, that is, it's so thoroughly fearful of and hateful towards gay and lesbian people, that unless we actively talk about it and act against that homophobia sets the tone, and that by its nature is exclusive. I want to just mention a couple things about what I think can be done, and then the rest of it we can do in discussion. But at the very, very least, we can begin to challenge anti-gay jokes and statements. That's a starting point, at least, for ways that we can begin to move towards being inclusive of gay and lesbian people. It doesn't mean you have to agree with everything about gay and lesbian people, but at least we can start with the point that gay and lesbian people shouldn't be persecuted, shouldn't have inflammatory or persecuting statements made about them. And then there are lots of other things we can do. If people want to move a further step, who begin to think about ways to make your language and your conversation gay sensitive. Always assume that a gay or lesbian person is listening to what you say, and chances are you're right. In any group setting, there is a gay or lesbian person listening to you, so be aware of that. I oftentimes, people ask me about, is Holden an inclusive community? or affirming your gay and lesbian people. Well, it's better than most. I will grant it that. It is better than most. There are two problems. Holden does not exist in isolation from the broader society. And so while there are many gay and lesbian people who generally feel supported here, they still won't choose to come out because that identifies who they are, and we still have to go out into the rest of the world, which is not very supportive. Secondly, however, if you think about it in all the very subtle ways, Holden's not terribly affirming. It's an overwhelmingly heterosexually identified community. All you have to do is just listen for a while to the kinds of examples that get used here, the kinds of common jokes that we laugh at, the kinds of rites of passage we celebrate. We're always singing happy anniversary to heterosexual couples. I've yet to ever be at Holden Village when that's happened with a homosexual couple having their anniversary celebrated. If you think of it just in terms of fairness, 10% of the time we ought to be using gay and lesbian examples to illustrate who we are as a community. But that doesn't happen here. And so while Holden is generally a fairly supportive place, it has a long way to go in terms of becoming an inclusive place. I think I'll stop with that, and the rest can come out in conversation.
Okay. Thank you. Please say one or two other things and then just open it up. What we've heard here are three, it seems to me, very, very important brief reports of the ways in which different groupings and different individuals have felt excluded in the larger society, in the church, and at Holden. And those challenge us, it seems to me, to rethink who we are. There's a fourth panel chair in the front here, and I think we have that fourth panel chair up here empty to symbolize the fact that there are huge numbers of groups that also would feel themselves excluded from the Holden community and from the church. That's an empty chair that is particularly empty this particular time at Holden of people of color. On the staff, on the teaching staff, people who are working on this question of inclusivity. Holden has been working on that question for virtually all of its existence in a variety of ways and continues to work on it. But it continues to be a huge challenge to diversify this community in a way that a whole range of very different people bearing very different gifts can become a part of the same community. So the empty chair is there for a reason, to remind us that we have a long way to go. Let's open it up to gather some comments. Let me suggest just some ways in which you might want to enter the conversation. All of us, I suspect, even those of us who are white and male, sometimes feel and have particular reasons to feel excluded from a variety of communities. And sometimes all of us in the room, no matter what our sort of attributes, find ourselves in a position of doing the excluding. So partly we want stories about doing the excluding ourselves. We all do that in various ways, right? Barriers we put up, or barriers that we feel, or invitations that we feel when we are not the excluder, but the excludee, right? So we've got two identities to deal with here, and we've got two ways of acting. We raise barriers and we invite. Let's talk about being excluders, being excludees, inviting, and raising barriers. Again, my premise is that we all are both excluders and excludees, and we all both raise barriers, and we do inviting. Let's talk about ways in which you've experienced both of those, either here at Holden, in your home congregation, in your home town, workplace. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure if this would be a madam chair or if it would. If the representative divorce / and/or single parent.
Could you speak up?
Say
please?
Some more. Could you say some more about?
I'm not sure if there would be an additional chair, or if Ingrid and Dan would share the chair of a divorced parent. That could be a male or a female. It could be an unmarried parent. But there is exclusion in that area of church.
Often feeling left out, and in fact, being excluded.
And in fact, for instance, in my own case, had I been a widow, I think the treatment would have been different from the church body.
It would have been different.
I think so.
Yeah, so the fact of divorce labels you in some way with the church.
I have a question. It's not really a question, but Before we go in one way, one way that you could include hearing impaired people here is that if you're going to talk, if you could please raise your hand, because I look around and I don't know who's speaking.
Okay.
I see the interpreter, but I don't know who's speaking. Okay. So if you could just raise your hand, then the hearing impaired people would know.
Very good.
That would be very helpful.
Okay, let's identify ourselves. Dan.
If I could just respond to that briefly, my experience is not being a divorced person, but one of the biggest surprises to me that ever happened when I started speaking about being gay was the number of divorced people who came up to me after I would talk and say, I really found your talk so helpful because the kind of pain you felt by being excluded is the same way I felt with all the moral judgments, all the Bible verses, all the not fitting in anymore. And that really was an amazing experience for me. Since that, other people who've spoken to me afterwards have been people involved in 12-step programs or addictive behaviors, who have felt very much judged for being alcoholics or other people involved in compulsive behaviors, and people who have suffered from sexual abuse or incest and have not been able to, felt like they've not been able to talk about it. Interesting things is I participate in a church that's predominantly made up of gay and lesbian people, but we have a rapidly growing heterosexual segment of the church, and oftentimes they've experienced these kinds of things, either divorce or incest or some experience where they no longer feel included in a heterosexually identified mainstream church, so they come to a gay and lesbian community because they feel accepted there and included.
Others, experiences of being included or excluded?
Yes. I have a question though. In order to have an inclusive community or society, there has to be something that binds us together. That means there has to be a certain norm by which we include, but also can exclude. In other words, I mean to make it simple, if a Buddhist, and I have many Buddhist friends and I love them, but if a Buddhist monk in a yellow robe with a guitar walks up to the table where the blood of Christ as wine and the bread, etc., and he says, hey, get me some of that booze, I think we have to exclude this and say, sorry, not yet. Maybe later, but not now. So there has to be a kind of a norm to include and exclude. Otherwise, anything goes. Now, where is the norm? And what binds us together?
All right, so the question is the identity of the community, the way in which boundaries are drawn around it. Anybody want to respond to that? Barbara?
Well, I think that's a good example, John, because I think that that is, I mean, I think that's where we would want to say, at least for the Christian community, yes. The line is, it's the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the world, I mean, certainly what binds us together most fundamentally is our common humanity, and that it, except, I don't know what I think about excluding people from community, but as a society, I think we have to say every single person is part of our family, and there are no excluded people. But in the church, that's exactly the place where you want the boundary to be, not on sexual orientation, not on disabilities or women or men or gender or anything like that, but right there with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So that's the perfect example, I think. But I guess your question would be more is, do you think that some of these other areas are contrary to the gospel, or?
That could be. I mean, I can see that somebody dressed up in an SS uniform will not be admitted to a synagogue. Maybe he should be, but I can see why not. Especially from Jewish people who came through concentration camp.
Other comments on the question of common identity? Yes, ma'am.
I think the cross is the boundary or the border. For us, that is the inclusive.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
As a female and someone who's certainly benefited from some of the things from the feminist movement, I still have difficulty in dealing with the fact that sometimes I see our inclusive language as no longer celebrating the differences between the various sorts of people that we have. And I think it comes partly out of the person's experience of being excluded, that language is exclusive. But I hate to see us lose all of the variety and the richness that we can have from identifying, say, the maleness of certain images of God and the femaleness of other images. The image of the church is female and God is male, and there being a relationship there is an image that I don't want to let go of. And yet, I can see where for some people God is a very threatening thing, but God being female could be a threatening thing for someone else. And I think we have to be sensitive to the fact that we can't have all the images one way or the other. But I hate to give up all the images to total neutral ones.
Okay.
Yeah. I really like what you said about celebrating differences. Often the hearing impaired community will do that in church. But hearing people don't know we're doing it. Example, the song, Over a Thousand Tongues to Sing, and we translate that, Over a Thousand Hands to Sign. We do that, but the hearing people don't know that when we're signing it, and so they miss that opportunity to celebrate with us. I wish we could be more open, like you said.
A wonderful example. Scott?
For exclusive communities who desire to be more inclusive, but recognize that because of the social structures of our time, they're not going to be more inclusive. How can they feel good about themselves? What kinds of strategies could they employ to be addressed to all three of you? You mentioned one, Dan, about more consciousness about metaphors we use, jokes that are going around. Ingrid, you obviously alluded to the need for exclusive communities to have conscious strategies to provide opportunities for more leadership from women.
I'm probably a sucker, but every single time I see any exclusive community trying on change or thinking about change or talking about change or trying it in a different way once, or modifying a little bit of language, I'm completely bought out. I completely go for it. I think this is wonderful. And I think a lot of people who are excluded just want some signs that there is an attempt being made and there's some learning going on and that there's some consciousness of it.
Anything, Beth?
I was thinking, while you were talking, I left the church I'm in LCMS. We're a little bit behind LCA. We got a new pastor. And he didn't like women. And he didn't like deaf women in church work. And he didn't like deaf women in church work with him. So he gave me a really rough time and I resigned. It was really terrible. It was a lot of suffering. Anyway, but we people really got together and we voted him out. We kicked him out. And we got a big scolding from the Senate representative. At the same time, they told us privately, way to go. But I was angry. But I was angry because in front of everybody, he scolded us. But behind closed doors, he said, way to go. And I got really mixed messages about that. Why? Why does that have to happen like that? Why do pastors go through the seminary thinking that they are gods of the church with full power over everyone? That's a wall that I got. But it's also a wall that we broke down when we took the risk and got together and voted the pastor out.
What a powerful story. Spence?
Yeah, that is a very powerful story. Scott, I think that's a wonderful question. Partly would answer it, I hope no community that knows it's exclusive is ever going to feel too comfortable with being that. I mean, I hope there's always going to be a certain level of discomfort, of knowing that we could be doing better. And I say that on behalf of my own community. I think one of the most important things any community can do is to try and honestly come to grips with how it views difference in itself and in the wider society. Because that's real key. That's one of the major key distinguishing factors between these two visions. If difference is viewed as threatening or something that we have to learn to live with, that's very different than understanding that difference is part of the diversity of creation that we celebrate and that we welcome. And I was looking, it was for me, having the hearing impaired here this week has been a wonderful gift for me to have to examine this, because there are times when I feel like, oh my gosh, if I have to try and learn one more sign, this is really frustrating. I'm having to, you know, it's pushing me. Versus the times when I'm watching like the signing choir going up there and saying, my life has been so impoverished without having hearing impaired people in my life. And so seeing difference as something that adds greatly. And I wanted to just mention this a little bit. Some people who have studied the way human communities respond to difference have put together a little scale that goes from the beginning point of repulsion, of being repelled by difference, all the way to appreciation and nurturance. And it's very interesting because these people, the first four, they list as negative levels of attitudes towards difference, and the final four is positive levels of attitude. And I think what this reveals is that in the negative attitudes are repulsion, then pity, then tolerance, and then acceptance. It's always interesting to me that they consider tolerance and acceptance as still being negative attitudes, because I think that's oftentimes the most that we think we can ask for the church to do, is get to a point of either tolerating or accepting people who are different. In positive levels, they list support, admiration, appreciation, and nurturance. And not to make this too long-winded, but what I would say my experience of a place like Holden or community is that I experienced two different levels going on. I experienced the levels of the individual interactions I have. And at a place like Holden, I experienced a lot of support, admiration, appreciation, and nurturance from many individuals in the community. That's different, I think, though, than what the community itself can or is doing. And there, as a community, I think I would put Holden more in the tolerant to accepting level. And what a community can do by discussing together how it views difference is keep in mind what's possible for the community as a community to do, but also then what's possible for individuals in the community to do to maybe nudge the community along.
Thank you, Dan. That's helpful. In the back, you wanted to get in. Yes, sir.
I have a problem with some things that Dan said. I worked for many years in the Diocese of Newark for Jack Spong. And Jack has been trying to drag the Episcopal Church into human sexuality for many years. And last year, he initiated the process and ordinated a gay person. You may have read about it, but he violated the spirit of the presiding bishop to study the problem a little bit more. He went ahead and ordained the gay person. Now, what happened was, 3 weeks after he ordained the gay person, the minister went on television in New York City and proceeded to make very disparaging remarks about Christian marriage among heterosexuals. And he embarrassed Jack Spong tremendously by doing it, to a point where Jack took back the ordination, rescinded, put it into limbo, and had his standing committee investigate this person, the gay person. Now my feeling on the subject is, if we're to study this more and go out and take chances like he did, where, how far do we go with it, and where do we say yes or where do we say no? I don't know. I just know that my friend is standing there now with ego over his face among his peers, and after having taken the chance, I don't even know what's going to happen to him. I know he's come before a board of review of the Episcopal Church, and I'm sure he'll handle himself well, but it's a very embarrassing situation that has happened in the gay community, especially in the Northeast.
Okay, thank you. Interesting question. I don't know if anybody has any brief comments on that. It's certainly not a situation that is unique in its difficulty to the Episcopal Church at this point. Obviously, other mainline Protestant bodies are struggling with these questions as well. April?
I hear the pain that people are going through as we struggle with these issues about people's lives and all. And I hear the pain that can happen as we make decisions and get egg on our face and all that sort of thing. But the pain that I have when we talk about it in that way is, how painful is it that while we try to get all the answers, which I think, you know, that was Adam and Eve's problem in the beginning, is that we exclude people while we're looking for the answers, rather than saying, gosh, let's be a community, let's work together to find these answers and struggle together, rather than saying, you go over there until we figure out if we want to be with you. And I think that's painful.
Okay, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I think that's a real problem. And in our church, and I see our church as one big place, one big group of everybody. And here I see a deaf church, I see the mainstream white, black, white male church. I see, like in Everett, friends of mine who pulled away from the church to develop a women's church because they felt so left out. And I see a gay church. What do we have? We have segmentation. We have a breaking apart of the Christian church when we're trying to bring it back together.
And then the question becomes, what is at the core of our faith that can reunite us in various ways? Yes?
I was just about to make the same point that she was making. slightly different perspective, and that is that as a member of a mainline white type church, how do I respond with inclusiveness, which is hard enough to stretch our minds to do, when many of the people who have these differences are more comfortable at this point in time in at least a congregation of their own? It becomes somewhat of a self-perpetuating problem. And I think both sides have to struggle with the issue of, it's more comfortable for everybody the way it is now, but that's not the way we want it to be for good, and how are we going to manage to make that transition? I mean, I don't think we have an interpreter in our congregation, and how does that make us possible to include deaf people till we get some more? Mm-hmm. And, you know, with maybe gays or feminists or something like that, it might be logistically a bit easier, but maybe some of the emotional issues are even harder for both sides.
Okay, thank you. John?
Going back to the story of this minister or pastor who was ordained and was gay, then goes on TV and makes stupid remarks about heterosexual marriages. It is not that the man is gay, it is that he is making stupid remarks. And then we go turn that around and say, well, now you do that because you are gay. Mm-hmm. No, because you're stupid. I mean, let's keep this thing in perspective. And that somebody gets egg on his face on account of his stupidity, well, that's painful.
Though it's certainly true, isn't it, that we hear constantly that there may be some double standards at work, that there are standards of perfection for people who have been excluded, which are somewhat higher than we sometimes have for people who have been included longer, perhaps. Others, a few more minutes. Yes, ma'am.
I was just reading recently in The Chalice and the Blade about the early church, as well as societies way before the Common Era, where men and women were equal, where the society was all equal, where any metals used were used for tools of labor and not for arms. And she talks about in the early church, it was the same way, that people were on an equal basis. And then who came in, the Romans or who did it? I don't know, but we're so embedded in this white male system now, I don't see hope for a lot of years. I think the white male system is just dominates everything economically and every aspect.
White, straight, male hearing system.
Yeah. You knew what I meant.
Absolutely. Yes. But you've also told us, reminded us, that there are resources in our history as a people and as a people of faith that can raise a different kind of vision for us. Mm-hmm. Yes, Linda Park.
Well, I really resonated with what you said, because I've been for 20 years in the battle for inclusive language. And I'm one, too, who pulled away from the church and joined a women's spirituality group where those issues were pretty well resolved for all of us. And yet still, my choice isn't to be outside of the church. And I continue to sort of open the door and peek in and go to a service now and then and wind up getting angry. And what's interesting, what I wish a lot of mainstream church people would realize too, is how many of us like that are out there. So many of my friends, so many people, my peers, so many women feel excluded by the church, by the language. And I don't think people within the church really understand that. And how else could they say it's not an important issue? Because so many of us have been alienated and aren't even there to speak for ourselves, and that's why we keep kind of knocking on the door now and then and seeing if it's safe to come in yet. But it's very, very hard, and I really do share the pain that you expressed.
Thank you. Barb and then Jackie.
Well,
This is to respond to what you said there, John, just musing on the situation of the guy in New Jersey, who I didn't hear on New York TV. I'd love to hear if you did, Dan, what you thought. But I think that that gets, though, at part of the challenge of true inclusiveness, which is it might mean a shaking of our norms. I mean, I think one model of inclusiveness is where you have sort of a heart and center that you call normative. And I think in the church, let's just admit it's a husband and a wife and some kids. That's the normative social lifestyle. Then if we want to be sort of affirming, we can bring in other people sure. around the edges, like single people, hearing impaired people, people of color, and who are different from that norm. But that remains in the heart and center.
Right.
I think, I have no idea what he said. It does sound like that guy made some overstatements that I would not agree with. I think he challenged celibacy also and said that it's impossible, which we know not to be the case.
Right.
But still, I think the inclusiveness, I would say that that one model of inclusiveness where you hold up a norm of this great white middle class family with the husband and wife and happy children is not the model of inclusiveness that the gospel calls us to, that it's to not be the majority anymore, to really not have one standard that's normative. I mean, that's part of the, I'd say, oppressiveness maybe of Holden, too, is that that, especially in the summertime, that model of the family is so central because that's just the majority population here. And so divorced people might feel more excluded, single people as well, and certainly gay people. But that I think what that guy was challenging is some of those sort of basic things that I don't think are of the essence of what we want to make the norm of the gospel. And
right.
it was earth-shaking for the church. And you say stupid. I don't know if I would agree that everything you said was stupid.
No, but I mean, what I hear, and I didn't hear the story, I didn't look at the TV story at that time. I just heard here that the basis was that he made remarks upon marriages which are not gay.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with him being gay.
Right.
They are just remarks which he shouldn't have made.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you. Jackie?
Yeah, I was just going to respond to Linda's comment and sitting here wondering why sometimes I don't speak out more on observing the exclusivity and why more people don't, you know, come forth with feeling excluded or whatever. And I think some of it has to do with what Dan was talking about in terms of to do that, what's the tension or the balance between critiquing your own community and yet still wanting to be in there? Because I think for myself to maybe challenge sexism or exclusion that I might observe, I risk that people individually within my community that I need too in other ways will then exclude me further or will label me or will whatever, and so the pain increases to even be an advocate for the exclusion that you see. And it's not to critique them individually, it's to critique, you know, the corporation of that or the community of how that happens as us all together, not a person individually. And usually that exclusion happens in a leadership capacity, which, you know, is even harder. So I think some way we need to be able to allow that to happen without excluding people further from, you know, trying to ask for that. And the other thing I was going to say about separate groups needing to kind of break apart, I'm not sure that's always such a terrible thing. I don't know that our unity that we need to have in our faith necessarily means that we're always unified on every issue, but that maybe it's something else. And I like the notion that we've heard from some people this summer of how the gospel is really a kind of a vision for the future, or it's a looking ahead kind of thing. And I don't think that the breaking apart necessarily is always a permanent kind of thing. It may be just a stage in a process that people need to experience some community in their exclusion to even voice it and to even, you know, lift it forth so that it could become even more inclusive. So that doesn't scare me too much.
Thank you, Jackie. A couple more comments.
I just have a comment on what Barb has said and Jackie. As a married woman with two children here at Holden, a family, there were three of us women talking this morning, and two of us are married and have kids, and the other is a single woman. And I felt very awkward and uncomfortable talking about our kids. The conversation went on, and I was thinking, this conversation has gone on too long about kids with this single woman here. And I wish that if she felt uncomfortable, she would have said something. I don't know what she would or could have said, but not being single any longer at almost, you know, well, I won't tell you how old I am. I've been married for almost 20 years, and so I don't remember what it's like to be single. And I think it's important for all of us to speak up when we're uncomfortable. I don't know, is that...
Thank you. It sounds like your sister may have been communicating with you anyway, right? Making your own discomfort kind of be real for you.
I wonder, because she wasn't saying anything,
right.
Probably.
Yeah. We're drawing near the end of what has gone very quickly, at least from my point of view, as an hour's opening here. I really would like to draw only a comma behind the conversation at this point. And I wonder whether as a sort of special center of giftedness, which is drawing us all out into these questions, whether there are any folks from the hearing impaired community who would like to add a comment at this point. Beth or anybody else?